accession number 4847, reel 2.
Major Irwin, reel 2.
The camp at Laufen was a bishop's palace in Laufen, on the river connecting Laufen with Salzburg. I don't recall what its name was. Of course, at that time there was no frontier. Today, and I visited Laufen on one occasion several years ago, there is a frontier, and you actually have to cross from Bavaria or Bavarian into Austria. As I say, it was the bishop's palace. I can't recall whether it was the 7th or the 14th of June when we arrived there, and I do recall the gate clanging, and I emphasize the word clanging, behind us, and we were there inside.
Can you describe what the accommodation for the POWs was like?
Yes, we I was located in room 64 in the Bishop's Palace in Laufen. There were three-tiered bunks. We slept on straw palliasses. Of course, we only had what we stood up in. Most of us were in the battle dress in which we'd been captured. It was extremely cramped. About eight of us would mess around a table 6 feet, no, not 6 feet, 4 feet long by 2 feet wide, and that was a mess. Each little corner of the room, you set yourselves up in messes, and that was your mess, and your mess would be called for the soup and for the bread. And the potatoes, which was the staple diet, all of which led to one having to get up at night. So there was a continual clamping to and fro from the abort, the German for toilet, which was outside. But it was very cramped, and we were, of course, all very, very weak indeed. We used to have things called blackouts. Room 64 was on the second floor, and we used to have to walk up to that from the parades, and we were fairly weak by the time we got there. Of course, we had no books. We had to rely upon our own material resources. The first thing the Germans did was to shave all the hair off our heads, and then, funnily enough, I think all the beards had to come off too. Most chaps had grown beards by then, I'm fairly sure they had. And then they photographed us, and those photographs were to remain the permanent photographs on our records throughout the time we were prisoners. We didn't know how long it was going to be, but of course that record lasted for 5 years. I think subsequently I managed to get hold of mine, but lost it years later.
What was the morale of the prisoners like at this time?
Well, it's very interesting that you should discuss morale. Of course, I can only be strictly honest and straight about it. I can be nothing else but that. I would say that morale at Laufen was extremely low. I say I can only be honest at my time in life. We had There's a senior British officer, a gentleman who should be nameless for this. He subsequently, tragically, committed suicide in Germany.
In a POW camp?
Yes, I think it was in 1943. Suffice it to say that he walked out of a third floor window. I think he was a weak man. In fact, I know he was a weak man. I fail to understand how he got his command as he did, because the regiments were served under him did superbly. I won't say where it was that they did superbly, but it's a pace which was of extreme importance in getting the BEF away from Dunkirk. Extreme importance. Those regiments were sacrificed. Maybe he did extremely well, but I think he thought that we could come to a compromise peace with the Germans. And compromise peace was fairly frequently talked about at that time in that camp. I think the youngsters felt that they'd been let down, they'd been misled. And I would suspect that many of them had little respect for some of the senior commanding officers of regiments. Many of those commanding officers, in fact, I would say practically all, had fought in the First War.
In what way did these younger men think that they'd been misled?
I think that we'd been told about German tanks being of cardboard. I don't think we... our propaganda was such that, as I've said before, we were invincible. The British Empire per se was an invincible entity. That the Germans just weren't going to do this to us. And of course they did.
This talk of compromise peace, was this amongst the senior officers or amongst the junior officers or both?
No, I should think... probably mostly amongst the senior officers, but it got down to the junior officers, and the junior officers, I mean, we were so young that we were bemused by it all. I mention this specifically because you asked about morale, and I'm going to contrast morale when you ask me the question about what happened 18 months later. But I will continue with this if you wish me to do so.
Well, let's bring in the contrast with what happened.
All right, the contrast with morale was absolutely fantastic. We'll deal with the question of morale now, then we can revert to questions which you might wish to ask about Laufen.
Yes.
There was a shakeout, and some officers, mostly second lieutenants and lieutenants, went to Poland. I say I was an acting captain, temporary captain at the time, so I didn't go. Although my substantive rank was lieutenant. They went off to Poland to a different ambience, the young chaps together. We, in October 1941, were subsequently moved to a camp, it might have been 6B or 6C, off flag 6B or 6C, in Warburg by Kassel in northern Germany. There we came across officers of the Royal Air Force. There were probably between 200 to 400, and these chaps were absolutely terrific. They had guts, they just had that something, and morale went from zero upwards, and it never declined again from that moment. The camp to which we went from Laufen, I would think, was a hutted camp. It was probably the worst I was in, excepting the one in the last few weeks of the war. But there was terrific morale there.
You talked a little bit about the rations you received at Laufen. Were you receiving Red Cross parcels at this time?
No, we didn't get Red Cross parcels for, I suppose, about a year. We didn't get Red Cross parcels or real clothing. Maybe we got perhaps after about 6 or 8 months, a quarter of a parcel. There were one or two officers who'd had friends outside. We used to get parcels from Lisbon, tins of sardines, which someone arranged for us, which were extremely useful.
Was this a private gift?
Private parcels. Incidentally, I still have the telegram where my father was advised that I was reported missing, and it was several months before my mother and father were advised that I was safe and a prisoner of war. I mention this now because in my family, my father served on Malta from 1941 to 1943, in Malta's worst time. My brother was in the RNVR, and he was at most of the landings, from those in North Africa to those at D-Day. I also had a brother, who I think was probably the best of the three of us, who was failed to become a pilot, but became a bomb aimer, and was subsequently killed on the bomb site over France in August 1944 on his 37-38 mission. He was a wonderful chap. He got a DFC. But I mentioned the question of these telegrams and how shattering it must have been. For my family. Okay, carry on. No, the rations continued. The soup, the potatoes, and the bread. You would have a loaf of bread. Let's say a loaf of bread was going to be amongst five of you or six of you, and this lasted until the end of the war. I recall even right until the last days, the loaf of bread, which was the fifth, was to last you maybe for so many days. It would be cut into the number of portions. Let's say it was five, and then one of us would turn his back to the loaf, and a chap would, an officer would point at the, a member of the mess would point at the piece of bread and said, "Who has this? Charles. Who is this one? Chris. Who has this one? Henry," etc. So there was no question of anyone getting a, everyone got fairly dealt with.
What was the method of contacting your home? How could you communicate?
Well, we were given, I don't know, it might have been, I still have some of them, about four letters. It could have been three or four letters a month. I don't know whether it was as many as that. I can't really quite recall. But maybe a postcard. And you wrote these, and they were censored by the German censor, and off they went. And then after about 6 months, I suppose, letters started to arrive from our families. Yes, I should say between 4 and 6 months after capture, maybe October, November, December 1940, letters started to arrive. I remember my own letters. I used to write minutely. I didn't wear glasses, write minutely, until eventually the German censor called me in and said, look, we can't even read this. You really must write large or else we can't send them. So that was the way we communicated with our families. It worked comparatively well.
How did the POWs spend their time there?
Well, initially, of course, there were no books. I spoke French and Spanish. I had lived in Spain in 35 and 36, which is where I'd first come across war. I'd seen both sides of the Spanish Civil War, although it was before the war started that I'd gone there to learn Spanish. My father had sent me there to learn Spanish. And I'd also lived in France, so I spoke French and Spanish, and I taught French and Spanish. And as I still hoped to go to the Indian Army, the reason why I wanted to go to the Indian Army was because I did not have the private income required to serve in a regular regiment of the British Army. And my own regiment, the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers in peacetime, would have required at that time a private income of between £200 and £300 a year, which was quite a lot of money. So I still hoped to go to the Indian Army, and I started to learn very quickly, in fact, literally within, I suppose, within 3 weeks of the gates clanging behind us at Laufen, I started to learn Urdu, the language of the Indian Army. And I was giving lessons in French and Spanish. There were no books. We were far too weak to do most things. I suppose we slept. There was one thing that I wanted to mention. Yes, books eventually came from the Bodleian Library in Oxford, and they really were absolutely fabulous. I mean, books were to be my salvation. I'd always been very keen on military history, and I'd hoped to go a long way in the army. I thought, well, there's still a future for me. And after, again, I suppose, about 6 months to 8, 9 months, maybe longer, books started to arrive. In fact, I got Urdu grammars, French grammars, these sort of books. And then I got some military histories. I don't know, I can't recall the first ones. Maybe it was the American Civil War that I first became interested in. Then I managed to get some from the First World War. I remember getting Wavell's book on the First World War, which I still have. And then the Mesopotamian campaign on the First World War.
These were at your request, were they?
They were at my request, yes. And subsequently, I started to lecture on military history. Remember, I was only a boy. I was only, I wasn't yet 22. And I was 21 years of age. But people would come and listen to me. And I would attract, I suppose, anywhere between 100 and 200 people. I suppose in Laufen there were 2,000 officers. Who would come and listen to my lectures on the campaigns of the First World War. And in fact, I remember giving a lecture. I got hold of a publication somehow or other which had given the outline of the German strategy and the German war in 1940, the Battle of France, the battle in France, before France, the Battle of Sedan. And I remember somehow I managed to collate a whole lecture on the campaign of the German army in France in 1940 and attracting people to that lecture.
Was this size of audience typical of all lectures being given there?
No. That was an exceptional lecture. In the smaller study groups, you might get some chaps started to learn law at that time. To mention some names, John Peyton, who I think was a minister in the Heath government, he studied law. Dick Troughton, who was to become the chief of W.H. Smith, he studied law. Other chaps studied horticulture, agriculture, but there were very few who really studied. I would say the percentage of those who really studied was very small. Then, of course, once we started to get accustomed to being on short rations, we were able perhaps to do slightly more, and theatre shows were given, and these were quite first class. One of the fellows I remember, Bobby Loder, what he did was outstanding. The chaps who put on those shows were really fabulous.
Were there people who did nothing, who just sort of rotted away?
Yeah, I would say that there were, yes, quite a lot of people basically did nothing. As I said before, the percentage of those who really studied or really decided they were going to make something of it, I doubt if it was more than 10%. The education officer was a man called Elliot Viney of the Hazel Watson and Viney, and seeing the interest that I had in the books and in educating myself, I became his assistant education officer. Eventually we managed to get an education room, I think probably in all of the three main camps I was in, but in order to get a seat in, the room was very small, in order to get a seat at a place, at a table, you had to be there pretty early in the morning, and I mean early in the morning, 5:30, 6 o'clock, 6:30, and to get your seat and to keep your books, that was your seat. And eventually we used to get early morning tea. In fact, it was the tea was your breakfast. I used to arrange for the I don't call it a barrel, I suppose, of tea would be delivered to the quiet room, the silence room, for the chaps who were there to have their tea, and they would work and study there and not get it in their rooms.
Did any of those people who did nothing commit suicide or show any signs of mental strain because of their failure to be active?
Visibly, probably not. I have seen a chap climb into the wire, and he wasn't shot. But it wasn't until 1943-44 that I saw him. I literally saw him in the wire. I suppose he went a bit mad, but no, I don't think anyone committed suicide. In fact, I'm sure they didn't. I think it just became a way of life.
What was the relationship with the guards, with the Germans?
Initially, let's go back to Laufen. We knew jolly well that they had the power to kill, so one was afraid of them, I suppose. One kept away from them. There was one very unpleasant incident at Laufen very early on. You weren't allowed to look out of the window. And I don't quite know what looking out of the window meant, if you put your head out of the window. Anyway, a guard took a shot at a chap who was looking out of the window and killed him. And I think we were very upset by that. Particularly as a man, I'm from Northumberland, he was a man from Durham, so... I don't know, perhaps others had a different attitude towards the guards, and so far as I was concerned, they were Huns, they were Germans, and I wished to have nothing whatsoever to do with them. I would say that of the chaps who counted us, the German officers who counted us, the only one for whom I would have called simpatico, the only one for whom I'd have had any empathy at all, and funnily enough, I met him 10-12 years after, in the 50s, after 1945 in the 50s, Hauptmann Daddy Dittmar. He counted us at the last main camp I was in, Eichstätt, and he behaved very humanly. I think he lost two sons in the war. The last one, the second one, latterly, in the last days of the Battle over Berlin, while as an anti-aircraft gunner. But he's the only one for whom I had any real empathy. I didn't learn German. I suppose the Germans had to keep us hungry. I didn't really like the way they treated us. I was hungry the whole 5 years. I couldn't really believe that these people had imposed their system upon the world. I had been in Germany in 1935. I'd been in Hamburg. My father was a ship owner, and I'd taken a pal of mine across on a tramp steamer. And I suppose we were, 17? And I'd been in a theatre in Germany, and I'd seen the rabble-rousing. I'd seen the Heil Hitlers, and... I had, of course, alongside all the others there, raised my right hand like everyone else. I didn't really like it. I'd also seen what went on in fascist Spain, where a chap hadn't raised his hand, and of course he'd been badly knocked about. And I must say, I suppose I'm a reasonably sensitive man, but I didn't like it. I didn't like the way the Germans behaved. I will say now that for years after, I didn't like to go to Germany.
So not learning German reflected this attitude towards them on your part, did it?
Yes, quite clearly, quite clearly. Other languages I was to learn, as I think I told you, I learnt... I did very well in Urdu. We eventually taking exams. Then I took the Institute of Language exams in French, Spanish, Italian, and Portuguese, and passed them all either with honors or first class honors, or with first class passes. And then I started studying Arabic. But there was no German. The Portuguese, interestingly enough, was to be useful because 25 years later I went out to Angola because I'd studied Portuguese. Then, in recent years, I'm talking about now, I've had to travel in Eastern Europe a lot. And, of course, German is a very useful language, and I started then and am still studying German because it is a useful language.